Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Perception is Reality, a production brought to you by the GWH Radio Network, where we bring you coverage and analysis of the independent wrestling scene around the southeastern region. And now, the GWH Radio Network presents Perception is Reality.
Hello again, everybody. November 20th, 2013. We're moving up in the world. Rich Tate cares enough about us that he's actually done us an intro. We're moving up to episode number 3. I am Trent Van Dries, and let's see, Thanksgiving's right around the corner next Thursday, and if you can't be thankful for anything this year, just be thankful you're not the turkey, I guess. And remember, kids, Rome, Georgia is a walk-up town. Why? Because perception is reality. It's up to you, man. And what a show we have tonight. This is a very, very special program. Stephen Platinum, one of our regular contributors, came up with the idea on his full disclosure columns on GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com of comparing NWA Wild Side / Anarchy to Saturday Night Live. A lot of comparisons there. All kinds of greats have come through and not so greats. People have gotten a chance. People have made it. But there's been good times. There's been bad times. But it has survived through it all, and I think Stephen had an excellent idea there. So we're going to spend tonight talking about NWA Wildside and Anarchy, its long run, the ups and downs, and we're going to have a panel discussion with several esteemed members of Anarchy Wildside on the panel, and enough of my blabber for a little bit. I'm not going to talk as much tonight, so this is going to be one of the better shows, and I'm going to turn it over to the man behind the switchboard, the co-host, Scary Larry Goodman. You have covered this product pretty much almost since day one, so you probably know more than anyone. So, Larry, I'm going to pass it off to you and let you kind of kick us off tonight. How are you doing, Larry?
Yeah, I'm doing fine. You know, and the guy in Rome did say, claim 1,700 paid for
there
that show.
To walk up
so, I guess that there is some reality to that perception. Or at least according to him, there is. I mean, I don't know. Maybe he did have 1,700 people there, hey? But, yeah, we got a special show tonight sparked by a series of columns by Stephen Platinum, as you said, comparing the history of wrestling in Cornelia, NCW / NWA Wildside / NWA Anarchy, and then Anarchy Wrestling, comparing it to Saturday Night Live, and a lot of interesting points made, and certainly worthy of further examination from our esteemed panel here tonight. And on the line right now, we have, of course, our co-host, Bill Behrens.
Yay!
Yes, and in our storyline, I get to be Lorne Michaels, which actually is not all that bad.
We're also joined by Todd Sexton.
Yay!
Hello?
I believe. Yes, are you there?
Yeah, you guys, you hear me?
Yes,
yeah.
Carrie, just fine.
Okay. Hello.
And also on the line
Todd
at this point
Michael,
is...
Todd would be Michael O'Donohue, by the way, just so we could get everybody good.
Is that who I am in the story? Because I was wondering what my part was. I'll Google him in a little bit when I get off the phone.
Well, if he's Michael O'Donohue, what does that make Jeff G. Bailey?
God.
Jeff G. Bailey is a spawn of Michael O'Donohue.
He's a Jeff G. Bailey would be Chevy Chase, I think.
That was what I was going to say.
That's not a bad analogy. That would probably be right.
I would figure more
and
of
Rick
a
Michaels.
Miller,
and would Rick Michaels be John Belushi?
Ooh, that could be a good or bad thing.
And that other voice you heard was Stephen Platinum himself chiming in there. He's in the penalty box for missing our last show. So he's going to have to be silent here for a bit and let others get their say while we make him serve out his penalty time. And later in the show, we're going to be joined by Rick Michaels, and then towards the end, the Reverend Dan Wilson, or Dan the Dragon, as he was known during part of his run in Cornelia. So, you know, to add some structure to this, I'd like to start addressing some of the points that Steve made in his three-part series. And, you know, in part one, it was mentioned that Saturday Night Live and Anarchy have been led well. And, of course, led by different people at different times. And we have got some of the people that involved that leadership on the line here. Would you agree with that assessment? And what would you say about the leadership of Anarchy through the Anarchy / Wildside NCW through the years?
Who are you asking?
You say who you want to start.
Let's start with Barron.
Well, it's sort of a tough spot because I've been there relatively from the beginning. I mean, there's a beginning to what became Wildside and became Anarchy, and it became with something Steve Martin and Ray Rawls were doing. I was doing something else. They came to me. We ended up getting together, and the company was basically launched on the premise of them doing one thing and me doing another, and very quickly it didn't work the way it was supposed to, and so the very first angle we started with was an angle based on truth, which sort of became the premise that I think developed a lot of where we went with Wildside and eventually Anarchy, which is pay attention to reality and try to present it as best we can within the fiction we're doing. So from the very beginning, I came in as the damn Yankee and the guy that was going to take over because the NWA was better than NCW, and I started by saying, you know, the two owners are incompetent. They told me they had all this advertising money they don't have. We are bouncing checks to TV stations. All of these things ended up being true. But it then started us off as being something more than just a wrestling show because all of a sudden we were telling a story. And the key, I hope, of what we've accomplished there is in twofold, always try to tell a story, and in the process prioritize developing the talent within the story, not just put on a show. There's a difference between booking and matchmaking, and I hope we always booked rather than just created matches. And so the beginning was the NWA is the bad guy and Rick Michaels and Steve Martin is the good guy until that was established, and then we flipped it and Steve Martin became the bad guy and I became the good guy, and off we went for a while. And that was the beginning. And eventually Wildside became more with WCW, and then eventually with the direction I really wanted to go in, which was not the perpetuation of the Southern wrestling people that we had all been using too much, but to develop young talent and to hope that people from all over the place would want to get involved with us, and it ended up becoming that. So Wildside evolved over time, and I hope Anarchy has had some ability to evolve over its history, and I've been able to be around all of that and work with talented people while I did it.
You know, I want to go back even further than that for a second, because Jeff Bailey's on the line, and Jeff, you were there before there was TV and before there was Bill Barron's there. Can you talk a little bit about that time in Cornelia?
Hello? Or not.
Oh, I'm sorry, Jeff. You there?
Yeah, I'm here. Can you hear me?
Talk a little bit about that time in Cornelia when before there was TV, before there was Bill Barron's?
Well, there was TV before Bill Barron's in Cornelia, I believe. They had a local show that Steve was doing and wanted to get their show on Bill's thing when they went to go see Bill, is my recollection of that time. There really wasn't that long a period of time before Bill was there. I mean, it was probably maybe 6 months. And, you know, there were some good shows and some good crowds. But, you know, those early days, there was a, you know, even when Bill first came in, in those early days, I mean, it's not like Bill brought anybody good with him or anything. I mean, so it just kind of, you know, grew from there, from
my contribution was I was already using David Young and Air Paris came in, I think. And then we had Frenchy and Silky and Dango, who's now back with us at Anarchy. And we were developing who we wanted and who we didn't, I think, at the beginning. Roadhogs. We had a variety of interesting talent at the very beginning. But we also had some standout people that yeah, we also had some standout people from the very beginning, many of whom were already at NCW. You know, AJ, obviously, and Rick was already doing well, and we had J.C. Daz and Scotty Wren and Terry Knight and Terry Golden and Jesse Taylor, and it just goes on and on. Just a ton of good people.
We had shot the angle with Crush and Ruckus in August, and then Bill was in at the end of September. So that was really just starting when Bill came in. That was the one big storyline we had going, or the one big one that I remember, because it was mine.
And I brought more black folk.
Yeah, they took great offense to that angle, as I recall. they weren't appreciative of being called Uncle Tom's.
The one I'll always remember from back then is what I believe it was K Crush putting Steve Martin's wife in a bag.
Yes.
Having her in the ring, in the bag. That was quite a memorable scene.
Yeah, I would
and that
say
was
that. The
in no, and that was in no way mine. That was definitely one of Steve and Ray's. That was one of their spots early on, for sure.
Yeah, them. Okay.
That one,
you know,
I didn't book, I swear.
In Steve's article, he lists out all the people, or not all, of course, but many of the people that appeared in Cornelia through the years. When you look at that list, it's pretty damn impressive. Wow. Of course, some were there more than others. Some only, like I remember Mickey James, I want to say maybe two times was in there. I remember Brian Christopher coming there.
Actually, I don't remember Brian Christopher coming in either, but that's okay. It's fine. I'll take credit for him, too. No, Mickey as Alex Liguori came in a few times. My favorite, of course, was the second time, and Adam Jacobs had found a stripper picture of her in a magazine, and most of the evening was spent with Adam trying to get the courage up to try to get an autograph, which I don't think he ever did.
By the way, I believe
we're
now.
We had good times. We had good times back in the day. But the key of that, you know, when you talk about Mickey and you talk about, you know, the variety of other people, there was a core of people that were already working with me. Some of whom were good. Some of whom were maybe not so good. And there were a core of people working with NCW that were already there. What eventually happened and continued was that people wanted to be where we were, and it was never about money, because they're never even. You know, no matter who was paying the money, there was never a lot. And the building's small, and there was never going to be a huge crowd. Yet there was something important going on such that people would make ridiculous drives. Ken Doan, Kenny Dykstra from WWE, we didn't know he was 15 at the time. We thought at 6'2 and looking like he was an adult that he was. First time he came down, his car was taken away from him in Baltimore by the police. I didn't know why. He just told me that. And then his mom paid for him to take a train or a bus all the way down. And from the train or the bus, he took another bus to a hotel. Then he took another cab to the building, which was 50 miles north of the hotel he came to. And then after his appearance was over, I gave him a drive back to his hotel room and bought him Taco Bell. And that pretty much is sort of the definition of how Wildside went.
By the way, we're now joined also by Rick Michaels.
Welcome
to the party.
Sorry, I'm late. I was sewing.
Without Rick Michaels bringing Steve Martin and that crew to Loganville, there never would have been a Wildside.
Bill, did you tell the story of the first time that I brought Steve to Loganville?
No, which was for Steve very frustrating, and everybody else seemed to. Ray had come in already, and he'd brought AJ and had appeared in Loganville, and he had said that, you know, they were doing a TV on the Alltel cable, and they wanted to get on the distribution that at that point, NWA Worldwide out of Nashville was on. Actually, I had sort of a distribution and a half. I had two different things, one bigger than the other. And the bigger one was actually fairly impressive and included Atlanta Television on WATL, albeit at 2:30 in the morning. People were watching that more than Jerry Springer, which was the competition. So it was actually something. And Ray came in, and I said, sure, I'll have plenty of time. And then he and Steve came in with Ray's dad and a camera, and they brought a video player, and they brought a TV, and they were going to show me the TV show. And, well, I was a struggling promoter, and I had bad health at the time, and somebody had to clean the concession area. So the entire time they're setting up this equipment and wanting to show me their television show and get me inspired with what they're doing, I'm, you know, trying to boil water and throw hot dogs in and make nachos and try to, you know, make an extra $100. And inevitably, Steve Martin, who got easily offended, I ignored him entirely. I paid absolutely no attention. I never watched the television show and barely said five words to him. And somehow he took offense at that. And that was the beginning. That was the very first time they came in.
Well, actually, we had to come back. We had to bring
it very well.
Actually, we had to bring it twice because the very first time, I remember that you were doing the concession stand thing, and we just kept waiting and waiting and waiting, and Steve was getting terribly impatient, as he always did, and he was like, screw this, Ray, let's leave. We'll, we can just keep doing the TV in Cornelia, and I'm like, well, let's just wait a little while longer. We waited, and still Bill continued to clean the concession stand. So we left, and Steve was furious. But I had somehow talked him into coming back the next week, so we hauled the TV VCR combo and the video cassette, and Bill sat down and watched it, and he's like, oh, yeah, okay, not bad. All right, I'll call you. And Steve was furious again because, like Bill said, he didn't say two words to him and was, as Bill says, easily offended.
Yeah. Yes. And that pretty much continued during most of my relationship with Steve, which actually we took to advantage when we began booking Steve as a character, because I would script things and not tell him. like when we were bringing in all the great stars of the NWA, and Steve was the Mr. Wildside, the man that had created the entire thing, the one that deserved credit for Matt Hardy, Jeff Hardy, all the things he used to claim credit for, Joey Abs, all the things he wanted to talk about. And I had Al Getz come in and start talking about the debut of Spunkmeyer, one of the great stars out of Nashville, Spunkmeyer. I'm sure all of you remember Spunkmeyer.
And as Al
began putting this guy over in glorious tones, and of course he was a huge piece of toast in reality, he just put him over as the greatest thing ever and a representative and everything that I was doing that was great with the company. And Steve got legitimately upset, and they were some of the best things we ever did with Steve. We never told him what we were doing. We simply fed him and what he believed and his ego, and it was all just wonderful stuff. Those were some of my favorite times, was not scripting Steve Martin and just letting him react to things. It was always very entertaining.
Steve was bound and determined that Bill was just there just to totally just kill the whole company. That was his interpretation of Bill in the beginning, was then that's of course where the damn Yankee started. The only person from Florida that's a Yankee. But of course that's where I got it from. But yeah, you were just hell bent that from Steve that you were there just to destroy all his hopes and dreams and everything that he had worked so hard to build.
Hey, Rick, where's
yes.
Steve now?
The last I heard, he had he was in Ellijay, and he was still he had hooked up with some older stripper lady and had a couple more kids and was still putting up satellites.
Wow. Hey, let me know.
Yes,
actually
Steve's taste in women actually led to the eventual divorce that had me owning Wildside several years before it ended, is that we all pretty much had a consensus that we had to get rid of Steve because of the girl he was with.
Wow.
Yeah, she was Steve was he had the nice three-story house, owned his own, you know, the TV repair business that I had worked for him when we had started the original NCW, and nice wife. She worked at the bank. Child. I mean, they were making money hand over fist, and he gave it all up for the Southern Belle Amy that he met at the gym that didn't even have a job.
Steve tried to get in on Anarchy.
Do I now?
Steve tried to. Hey, Rick, how you doing, by the way?
Hello, Howard. Who am I speaking with?
You're speaking to Todd.
Oh, hello, Todd. How are you?
I'm all right.
I was just thinking about you today.
How were you? Please.
Yeah.
I thought about you, too.
Well, that's good.
We'll probably get to that. But Steve tried to get in on Anarchy when Jerry first put me in the – Bill, you probably remember this because I had the conversation with you. Steve arranged a meeting with Jerry Palmer at a coffee shop up here in Cornelia with a whole drawn-out plan to buy a percentage of Anarchy and get the syndication and make it national.
Huh.
I walked out after about 30 long minutes of what Steve Martin does, and Jerry was like, oh, this sounds great. And I was like, you need to talk to Bill just to see. And then
yeah,
Jerry talked
to
Bill.
By the way, please note I didn't go to this meeting.
Yeah, Bill was not there. Bill was not there, so I figured I had to go just to make sure Jerry didn't sign the company away off the bat. And then luckily Bill got to Jerry, because Jerry was all gung-ho on it, and I was like, you need to slow to pump the brakes on this. And then Bill talked to Jerry, and that was the last – that's the last I heard of Steve, and that was 6-7 years ago was the last I heard of him, and he just showed up out of nowhere to try to get in on Anarchy.
Does anybody know the story of how Jerry – even got into Anarchy?
I do.
Well,
I'm sure
Jerry's first involvement was sort of tangential because, you know, he was employing AJ at one point, so he sort of was around it at one point, but never really involved.
Well, I remember.
But in terms of Anarchy, I don't know because it was you, and that was Al Getz.
Well, he came to one of the Wildside shows, and I believe it was actually you that said, you know, who is this guy in the back? And I had no idea. And then Alan said it was with him. So, you know, it all worked out. But then we were having a training, one of the training nights, and he had came, and he came up on the ring apron, and this is you had already given me back the company, and he came to one of the training things and said, "Hey, man, if you need a partner, I'd be glad to step in and help you out, man, anything I can do." And I told him, I said, "Yeah, okay, you know, I'm not really interested in doing anything right now. I'm, you know, got a lot of stress, a lot of pressure. I'm just, you know, I'm really not interested in it." So I was in St. Louis, and I was talking to Sal on the phone and, you know, just really going through everything and, you know, telling Sal there's no way I can keep doing the wrestling show and going through everything I'm going through and trying to worry about keeping my job and all of this. And he said, "Well, what about the Jerry Palmer guy?" And I said, "Sal, that guy, I don't really know him, but that goofball asked me if I needed a partner. And, dude, I don't even care about wrestling. I don't need another tag team partner." And he goes, "No, Ray, that's not what he was talking about. He was talking about a partner in the company." So then I felt stupid because I thought he was talking about being my wrestling tag team partner. And, so anyway, one thing led to another, and I eventually called him, and he bought the company. So that's how he actually, he, Al Getz, and myself met at McDonald's, not a coffee shop, but we met at McDonald's, and he had the contract there, and everybody signed it, and we were done. But that's how the original thing with Jerry getting involved was, he had said he wanted to be my partner, and I thought he was talking about tag team partner.
Wow.
Tremendous.
Actually,
at the beginning of Wildside, there was never a contract, good or bad. We never actually had a piece of paper that got what we did going. The deal was I was going to be TV boy, which meant I had at least the ability to, you know, to say no to booking things, although I was fairly active in it. And Steve and Ray operated the building, and any revenues that came in through the building were theirs to operate the company. So there was sort of a weird separation of powers at the beginning that worked in a half-assed way for a while.
Did you and Steve have a contract when – did Steve and you have a contract when you got it from Steve? Because I was – when I was moving into my house that I've got now, I was looking through a bunch of paperwork, and – dog, go sit down and quit walking on my feet. I had – I found a contract where when – I was bought out by Steve, so he
there was a two-part process where he first had bought you out. That was prior to me buying him out, and then after that, I had done a DVD of Before They Were Stars in the United Kingdom, and had gotten $20,000 for it, and I basically went, okay, I didn't expect any of this money anyway, so I'm going to give half of it to Steve to get rid of him. And fortunately, it was the right amount of money at the right time, and ended up being, you know, a good thing, because we needed a transition at that point. Steve was really, really good at some things and really bad at others. For example, you know, he's the guy that trained Andrew Thomas, who became TNA's top editor. So he really brought some things to the table, but as he got more dysfunctional in his relationships, that carried over so strongly to the shows that he became a problem as opposed to being an asset at any level. And a lot of the decisions, things he wanted to have happen, you know, and the greatest and worst example is Terry Knight being lit on fire, were things we had to move away from. We had to stop putting people through tables simply because there were tables. Or how do you do a better ladder match with tables? You pile three tables on top of each other, because, of course, three is better than two is better than one. And inevitably, that was more of how Steve's mind worked on things. It was the more things we can break, the more ways we can blow something up good in an SCTV sense, the better it was. And we were starting to get a reputation with the work rate people who were primarily younger, and while they were risk takers, Todd was part of that part with TNT and the Lost Boys, and then eventually the Briscoe brothers and, you know, various others that came in over the time, we began skewing younger. And while we were still taking risk, we were doing it in more of a, what eventually became the Ring of Honor style.
Yes.
And that transition was important to the evolution of Wildside and what eventually led to Anarchy and quite honestly led to the development of most of the people that came out of there inevitably. It was that style that got people noticed, whereas the, you know, what can we burn, what can we break, what can we jump off of, became the gravy rather than the meat and potatoes. And for Steve, that was the meat and potatoes. That's what he liked, you know.
Well, when we first had the concept of what we wanted to do with NCW, even dating back to Silva, North Carolina, we wanted to be the Southern ripoff of ECW, and, I mean, hence the name that I came up with, Hardcore Hell, because I was like, hey, Steve, they've got Hardcore Heaven. We'll have Hardcore Hell. So, you know, that was the mindset from the original get-go, was that we'll just copy ECW and do crazy stuff.
But the thing is, Bill, even today, Bill, Anarchy will still, you guys are not afraid to go violent. You guys are not afraid of that, which, you know, I think is a plus, even today.
People, for because I mean, there's a lot of guys that I work with that work at Anarchy, but I work with them at other shows, and you know, they'll be getting paid very good money, and you know, be really good crowds, and they are very watered down versions of what goes on at Anarchy, and the same as what would happen at Wildside. There's something about that, the history and that building, that guys will literally kill themselves. They'll set themselves on fire in that building for peanuts.
Yeah, well, and that was one of the key things that transitioned over time, although there was never really a huge payoff. By the way, the largest payoff in the history of Wildside was to Terry Taylor, just a trivia moment.
I like this shit all over myself.
Yeah, well, because I told him to pay Terry $750 to earn Micropata in a match. It was the most that they ever paid anyone. No one else ever got that kind of money, and most people that came in got nothing.
The only times I ever bitched about any kind of payoffs at that building were when Matt had just signed the developmental deal, and him and Jeff and Venom were coming in, and Steve says, well, I got Matt to come in for the show, and I was like, cool. And he goes, well, we're not going to be able to pay him what we paid him at NC or in Silva. I'm like, okay, why? I mean, what's the big deal? He goes, well, he feels like that, you know, it's a little bit farther drive. He wants $100. And I'm like, $100? What the hell's he ever done? So I was very, very upset about having to pay $100. But, you know, eventually I got over it. But then when, you know, we had to pay the $750 to Terry Taylor, I like to have hit the roof because I'm like, what the hell? Of course, then that led to, you know, eventually the WCW thing and stuff like that. So, you know, it all meant something, but at the initial point of having to pay this money, I was not really hip on that.
Let me ask a question. Jesse Baylor, are you there?
I am.
First of all, hello. Long time no speak. How you doing?
I'm good. How about you?
Good, man. Let me ask you, do you think that the television syndication was the most important reason why people would drive hundreds of miles to work there for little or nothing, or did it just become word of mouth with the indies, or what was the reason that people just started flocking, you know, to Wildside?
Well, I think without a doubt the television was the most important thing because the television aired everywhere. I mean, somebody could come from Massachusetts and go back home and watch themselves on television and show their friends. I mean, so clearly that beats the hell out of going, come see me at the flea market or the roller rink. I mean, it makes all the difference in the world. I mean, shows without television basically exist in a vacuum. I mean, if you're not there to see it, it didn't even happen. So, I mean, there's so few wrestling television shows of value, especially then. I mean, that was a huge thing for people to come be on television. And, I mean, we had great talent. We were producing great talent. There was great matches that were being recognized. And, I mean, who doesn't want to be part of that? I mean, I don't understand why people do stay in these crap shows and don't try and get out and do something bigger. But I guess, you know, it's because they're cowards.
And the thing is, also, Jeff, like for you, you know, nobody, I don't know if any manager has kept heat in one building as long as you have over the years. Now, when you saw these guys come in, was it a thing where you would say, okay, I want this guy, this is a tasty slab of meat, no, I don't want this guy because he's probably not coming back? I mean, was it just kind of a, you know, for you, just kind of a smorgasbord of opportunities for guys to manage?
At certain times, it was like that. At other times, it was, you're managing this guy, you know? Make it work. I don't give a shit if you like it. So, you know, it wasn't always pick and choose, but over the years I got to say, I really want that guy, or, you know, I'd really like to do something with that guy, and you know, make that happen. But a lot of the stuff, you know, especially in the early Wildside days, was just, you know, whoever they put me with.
Can I chime in on something here?
Sure.
I know from a fact that if anybody's watched the Bobby Heenan DVD, that the part where I think it's Arn Anderson talks about that anybody that they put with Bobby was just instantly looked at as a star. Well, on the level of Wildside and Anarchy, which I don't speak a lot on, can't speak a lot of the Anarchy talent, but I know from the Wildside days that it was almost when you got put with Jeff, it was looked at as you were elevated as a star. And I know from dealing with talent that there was tons of undercard heels that would always, hey, you think that, you know, maybe y'all could do something and maybe slide me with Jeff G. Bailey and I can be part of the Elite and da-da-da-da-da-da. So Jeff was, you know, and is, huge instrumental in building talent and making them even bigger than, quote, what they already were.
Okay.
And I'll chime in for a second, and this is to draw back a little bit to Steve's analogy that he was doing on Saturday Night Live, which we've sort of not really addressed at any great level, but part of
our indie level.
What makes a successful franchise work is you have to find things that provide you with a degree of consistency, something that your audience can use as a hook. They used Weekend Update would be an example of that for Saturday Night Live. There was something you'd always count on. They had a revolving group, but there was always something compelling that happened on that. It was always creatively written, and they used it as a launching pad for stars. And almost without exception, it was an important part of the show in almost every year of Saturday Night Live's creation. When we came up with the Elite started, actually, technically I started the Elite when I was doing the heel NWA thing, and Jeff was part of that almost as if he was my lackey at the very beginning. And eventually, thank God, I was turned babyface. Jeff kicked me in the face, and he ended up becoming the guy that dominated the Elite, the NWA Elite, who were and will always be the flagship team, the standard bearers of the promotion. They were the constant. And when you have a constant in booking, it gives you the ability to establish people because you're dealing with a known brand, something people already recognize as being important with somebody who has the capacity to get it over. You know, call that the guy, the Saturday, you know, the Weekend Update anchor, you know, the guy that gets the product over. And then secondarily, they could be at any time the focus for a storyline without having too much brain surgery because everybody wanted the Elite to be beaten. And then inevitably, you could use the Elite in the right situation even as the babyface, as happened for some of the fans at least when they feuded with the Rejects. So the Elite became integral. It became the linchpin that you need to establish episodic television and episodic storyline progression. You know, it was our Weekend Update, for, as I look at it.
Hey, Larry, do you think it's time to let our mascot out of the penalty box?
Maybe just for a moment.
Yes, please think.
Only if he's going to say something good about me. Let's keep this going.
Yes, I think I am going to say something good about you. One of the things about, like, the Saturday Night Live Anarchy thing is actually stuff that I kept out of the article. It was even longer at one point. And one thing that I wanted to talk about, definitely, and I wanted to get people's takes on this, was something that was great about Saturday Night Live was that there was a lot of discussion in the book about how, you know, they would have the after party, and that became a legendary thing with the Saturday Night Live crew. Is they would go to one particular place, all of them would meet, and they would hang out. and the, you know, celebrities would show up and that kind of thing. And the, and you know, and then and it followed the eras. In the 70s, it was like everybody was, you know, doing coke and having sex all over the place, and then, you know, things changed. And at I alluded to it, but at Wildside and Anarchy, those parties and those gatherings and whatnot, I think are an integral part of the culture of Anarchy and Wildside as well, whether it was like parties that Steve would throw or, you know, a group of guys getting together, because that's where a lot of stuff happens, where a lot of people make decisions on, you know, like, oh, maybe we could work together, maybe we could film this, maybe we could do this promo. Like all of that stuff, which I think is, again, part of the point of the Saturday Night Live thing was to separate what happened at Anarchy and Wildside from what almost everybody else does. Simply put, people cared more at Wildside and Anarchy, and I know a lot of wrestling groups will get mad about that, but there was a lot of creative guys and a lot of hungry guys in the early days who were like partying and, you know, living there. It's almost like they're the last vestige of old wrestling, which is another thing that I love. And Saturday Night Live subsequently was is kind of the old vestige of like the variety show. And I just thought that I was sorry that I had to cut it out. But, you know, often complaints I get about the stuff that I write is when it's too long and people go like, oh, I just can't, you know, we're in the Facebook era. So, but I wanted to hear about that, because whenever I hear stories about like gatherings at Steve's house or, you know, guys getting together and then we're going to go film this promo or we're going to light this tombstone on fire or all of that kind of stuff. I just, you know, that's to me as much a part of the lore of not just Saturday Night Live, but of Anarchy as well. So,
And I'll can stay out of this very quickly, because 99.9% of the after party shit I never went to. I would think you would find Lorne Michaels, if that's my analogy, he didn't go to those things either. Yeah, then whatever happened at that, you know, whether it was naked pictures of Skeeter Frost or whatever it was, would end up coming back through the building toward me, and at that point we'd figure out what to do with it.
Well, I can say this, I'll just chime in real quick. My after parties, they consist of me filming somebody shaving, and the rest is history. So that's all I got on that one, unless it was at McDonald's with me hawking the WWE merchandise that they would give me. So most of the parties were at Steve's house.
But there was a group that went over to Steve's. In fact, I told Ray early on and Steve at one point that they were going to have trouble, same problem Jeff Jarrett had at the beginning of TNA. It's hard to be one of the boys and to then be respected as the guy that's in charge, and Steve wanted to be that guy. And inevitably, that aspect of it, joining the after party, being one of the you know, idiots, didn't help that process. It made it harder for him to gain greater influence with them where he thought he was doing that. But yeah, you're right, a lot of the creative stuff, I mean, Jeff G was frequently the one going out and doing some of what became legendary promos. I know when Minister was in, I think it took an entire evening to get one promo done.
Well, I mean, speaking of the parties and the TV, I mean, I think when you look back on that stuff, you know, Andrew had just graduated college and wanted to be in wrestling television and had moved to Cornelia to live in Steve's house. I mean, just totally, you know, on a whim. And Andrew deserves a shit ton of credit for a lot of this early Wildside stuff. I mean, he was really part of everything in that early going. Because, I mean, even when Bill came in, it was a long time before Bill really took control. I mean, God, I don't think Bill said a word to me for, like, the first year he was there practically. You know, he's just kind of laying back and feuding with Steve and Rick. So that was a really awkward time. But I mean, we would go to Steve's and watch the show and drink and whatever and start thinking of different things to do. And I mean, obviously, you know, we wanted our TV show to be great. We wanted it to garner attention and people to see it and go, holy shit, I can't believe they just did that. And it's like when Jim came in, I said, you know, why don't we go to the graveyard? Because we are always talking about doing stuff in the graveyard. I did one with the Lost Boys for CBW where they're painting in their own blood all over this tombstone on a fresh grave, and which, you know, nearly got CZW kicked off the air, so they weren't real pleased about that. But with the same graveyard, we went up there. You know what I mean? It just shows how, you know, the thing about Saturday Night Live, those guys, you know, because most of the people, when they start them there, they're young. It's their first big thing. So everybody's gung-ho and excited, wanting to push the envelope and that kind of stuff. And, I mean, you know, we did stuff that obviously now I'm not going to go into a graveyard at 3 in the morning and set it on fire for a wrestling promo. You know, I just don't think that's a really good idea for someone my age to be doing. But at the time, it seemed, you know, like the greatest idea in the world. And, in fact, it was the greatest idea in the world. And that promo stands forever, you know, for people to see it, where these crazy people set this tombstone on fire for a wrestling promo. We almost set a house on fire in the woods to do one, and the only exit was out a window down a ladder, and we set this big pentagram on fire with the ladder for the Lost Boys and shit. And our exit strategy is we had a half gallon of water to pour on the fire in this tinder box of a shack in the woods, that the only exit is out a window down a ladder. And I mean, I had my wife with me doing this. So, I mean, you know, that's, I look back on that stuff, and that was wild side. You know, we would do whatever. I mean, me and Iceberg went out to the bridge where Wayne Williams threw the bodies off of, and traffic's whizzing by, and it's like December, we're like blowing steam, talking about throwing victims into the river. And, you know, I mean, it's stuff that it was like nothing else in any wrestling promotion. You know, I'm really, really proud of a lot of that stuff we did, because it stands the test of time, and it was all fresh. It wasn't copying anybody's stuff. It was, you know, all new. So it was pretty great. Great time. I mean, those early days of Wildside are special, and it probably doesn't get as much credit as it deserves for being what it was, especially at the time, which is pretty damn groundbreaking.
Well, I can chime in on party.
Yes, go ahead.
Yeah. Well, we had our little, I guess for lack of a better term, clique with me, Tony, Sal, Jimmy Ray, Blackout. And then when the Briscoes came to town, they'd stay at our place along with the SATs and Red, and Tony would end up in Bushes at our apartment. Dan Wilson, we could be counted on by midnight to be passed out on our couch without fail.
That's a given.
And there's pictures to prove it, because we did stuff to him
and
while he was sleeping.
There were towels in your bathroom that had hair on them. I mean, literally growing hair.
Oh, no, the towel in the bathroom, disgusting. But you figure it was me, Tony, Sal, and my brother, and then we had Blackout was there every weekend. Jimmy was there. Even Onyx made an appearance there. And there were times at the club where Rayman was thrown through the doors by security guards, and we were all asked to leave the club, and assorted of fun times. But like you said, hungry. We were all watching wrestling tapes. You know, whoever got the latest tape from up north or the latest show, and we'd watch everything, but we would have a good time and try to stay out of trouble, go to clubs, and Tony would piss everybody off, and then I'd have to go pick up everybody because Tony left Blackout and Dan at a club because they were making fun of his hat, and just all sorts of fun stuff.
Todd, you were one of those people that came into Wildside to was drawn there. What drew you there, and what was it like once you got there?
Reading about it, and if you remember WOW magazine, World of Wrestling, it was the first sort of shoot, and the only shoot-style magazine. And I was in Texas training with Tony, too, Tony Stradlin, training at Shawn Michaels' Rudy Boy Gonzalez School, and talked about Cornelia, Georgia. And growing up in Atlanta, I've never heard of Cornelia. And it would have, you know, in the independent section stuff, there's a picture of Bill with the Jim Cornette tennis racket thing. And, you know, talk about that. I can remember Bad Attitude, Onyx and Laz being mentioned. And when I came back after training there, and they shut the Sean and Rudy shut the promotion down for Christmas, so I came back to Georgia and then came over there, and they had the WCW deal. And so we got to see, you know, the Sean O'Hara, Helms, Moore, and guys like that in there. And, you know, and it was a production. You know, there was TV cameras. It was, you know, and then it was a big deal to get in there. I mean, and you didn't know the history because history was still very recent at that point, but it felt like a big deal going in there because you could tell, you know, a lot of people knew they were what they were doing. And it was, you know, Rick and Jeff and Bill, all of them were there. And, you know, it was just, it felt like this is the place you want to be.
Was the period of being a WCW developmental territory more of a positive or more of a negative? Question for Bill.
There's no question it was a gigantic positive, not the least of which is it allowed us to take a little bit of the perception of what we had become and make it a greater reality. There were weeks where we were doing five shows in a week. The way I structured the deal, the previous deal had been a deal Bert Prentice had, and Bert had made a mistake or two, surprisingly. And as a result of those mistakes, they took the deal away from him, and they then went and visited Les Thatcher's school and visited us. And God only knows why, because Les is brilliant and was doing a wonderful job. They liked us better. J.J. Dillon just, for some reason, couldn't stand Les's thing, so there had to be something else going on there. But anyway, we got the deal, and they came to me and said, well, Bert was making this amount of money, and blah, 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 and we got screwed, and yabba-dabba-doo, and he tried to do this. And I said, okay, fine. Then let's do this. What do you want out of the deal? And they said, we want our guys to get as much work as possible. I said, fine. Then let's base how you pay me on an amount of money per guy based on each time you send them to me, which means I'm going to make more money by having more shows. And they went, oh, so you actually want to work for the money? And I said, well, yeah, but at the same time, of course, we're getting this talent for free. You know, some of it doesn't matter. I mean, nobody knew who Danny Fakur was, but, you know, we got him. Or Robbie Rage, and we got him. But we also got Bob Sapp, and, you know, he was sort of fun. And we were also getting the stars, and at various times we'd have 12, 13, 14 of these guys. And I don't remember what the exact number was, but let's call it $100 just for want of a better word. And so we're making that money. And then what I told Ray and Steve was, I'll split the money with you guys for the shows you're promoting.
Bill, I found one of those that you had, where you had given me a receipt when you paid me for one of the Toccoa shows. And actually, you were getting $150 a person.
Okay. And Ray, you just mentioned, Ray went out very quickly and found a building in Toccoa and said, okay, I'm going to do a show, you know, because this, you know, I'm going to get free guys and I'm going to get paid to book the free guys. This is a good deal. Steve, that's how Fantastic Fridays started. We were running Saturdays on that every other week thing that he'd been doing, first and third back then, and it was, well, fuck, we'll start Fridays because we can get all these guys and we'll get paid again. And I really wasn't promoting anything. Young Andrew started doing Athens at that point, so we'd have occasional Athens shows. And every once in a while, I'd get a bought show, like the Horse Park Fair show that we did twice. But in general, Steve was promoting in the main building. Ray was promoting in another building. Young Andrew was doing Athens every once in a while. And then I'd occasionally throw in something. And in any one week, we had four to five shows. So that was one of the greatest benefits, is it got us really busy. We got an awful lot of talent that was well known, and it circulated around our talent. And during that period of time, two of our guys got hired, Air Paris and AJ Styles. And you put all that together, and the fact that we had, you know, people coming into the building who hadn't seen us before were being put over by WCW's podcast or radiocast they were doing at the time with Jeremy Barash and Bob Ryder, and you know, everybody, people are talking about us because they're in business with us. And perception is reality, as we go back to our theme here. And the more people talked about us, the more people that were coming in, the more shows we were doing, the bigger we are, even if we weren't that big. So WCW helped establish greater validity for what we were already doing, and it opened the door for us to continue doing that with greater validity after they left.
Now, was it limiting as far as you have to use this guy, you have to use this guy, you have to cut back on violence, like creatively, and who you had to use? Did it limit the product in, you think, or?
No, because Terry Taylor, who was our go-between, made it clear that these guys had to do what we told them. So if I wanted the Boogaloo crew to go over on Jindrak and O'Hare, no matter how much bigger Jindrak and O'Hare were, they went under. And so it was, you know, it was important, and it was important for the WCW young talent, even though it didn't last long enough for it to be as impactful as I think it could have been, is that they were given a better lesson in wrestling. Some of those people had worked with me before at various times, or our people had worked with them at various times over the good old days. So there was some familiarity also between our talent and the talent they send us, except for guys like Tank Abbott, who are getting first-class airplane tickets and hundreds of thousands of dollars to come in and throw bad punches.
Yeah.
And one great punch.
They threw one fantastic punch on one of the greatest nights we ever had, following one of the worst nights we ever had. One of the greatest nights in booking, and Ray will remember this. He's the only one who can, because we had had the terrible night the night before, and I was driving from my house to the building the second night, and we didn't even know if Sabu was going to be there. We had no idea. And I called Ray and said, I don't know that we can trust that Sabu will make it to the main event, and we have to have a backup plan. So the first backup plan is we're going to do a match between AJ and Air Paris in the main, and we're going to do an angle at the beginning of the show where we're going to take Sabu out. And then we'll figure everything else out as we go along, and if we get lucky, we'll do something we had never done in the building before. We'll do a lights-on, lights-off, and we'll do it twice in the main. First time would be Air Paris going, how can I have a show without freaking Air Paris? And then after that, you'd have the lights go off again right when there was about to be a table spot, and there's freaking Sabu. And if he was good that night, you had the potential for a great moment. And if he was bad, we'd never send him to the ring, and we'd finish the match without the lights off. We were ready to go either way. And it ended up being one of the defining great moments and one of AJ's favorites, because he got a nut shot in as his only offense in the entire match.
Don't forget about the best part about the start of that angle was that you said, you know, tank punch Sabu. But the way you build it was, this was the first time Sabu was going to come out and talk.
Yeah.
So that had never been done before, yeah. So that was a cool thing. And then Tank came out, ruined it, and punched Sabu in the mouth. And I always thought that was a nice touch, because it's like, oh, Sabu's going to do a promo, because Sabu didn't talk, and then Tank ruined that, and that set the table for later in the evening. So I thought that was a nice way to set everything up.
And Sabu, bless his heart, for his issues then and going forward at different times. He also is just supremely a man of the business. For weeks after that angle, he wore bandage on his chin, selling the broken jaw from the Tank Abbott punch.
That's right, he did, didn't he? Yeah, he's a man.
But again, that's an example of Sabu bought into whatever we were doing at that time, that moment with that guy was something he had to sell other places. It happened. It was real, and it was important, and it wasn't something that just happened in Podunk, Georgia, that you ignored.
I've got a question for Todd. I've been watching Anarchy for over a year now, and I like the product. You guys do a lot of good stuff, you know, but the Anarchy of now, it doesn't get a lot of press. Not a lot of people talk about it. More people talk about, you know, Wildside in the good old days. Is that frustrating for you, or why do you think that is? And also, talk about the crowds and stuff. What do you see as the future of Anarchy, and what does it need to do to stay relevant in the future?
As far as it not getting pressed anymore, Anarchy really has never gotten the press that Wildside did, which is funny, and I think everybody on the panel can back me up. There was a period where Wildside was consistently drawing better crowds consistently than Wildside did at certain points, but it never got the credit or the notoriety that Wildside did as far as outside talent wanting to travel so far for it. And I think it was a combination. I think Anarchy became sort of a combination of Steve and Rick's version of NCW and Bill's version of Wildside as far as combining the two aspects of the Southern brawling and then the younger athletic talent, and which is what I try to do is combine. You know, you want lions, tigers, and bears. And as far as the frustrating me overall, as far as not getting the notoriety, not necessarily, but as far as having people there, I mean, that's the main focus as far as I've always concerned is having people there and not necessarily internet or mainstream notoriety, although it would be nice, don't get me wrong.
Yeah.
Well,
Whenever Wildside first became really, you know, popular and everything was at that time there wasn't a whole lot of there was ECW, there was this, that, and the other, but there wasn't a whole lot of independent shows.
Yeah.
That were on TV. So it was like, you know, oh my God, what is this show on TV? The internet was just starting to really catch fire, and I don't even think there was a MySpace at that time, but I remember there was the Mid-South Board, and then we had, or the Mid-Southern Board, and we had an NWA message board, and, you know, everything was just in its infancy, but it was because it was all something that was very new. Now there's 800 million shows that have a TV show, they've got an internet show, they've got an IP pay-per-view, they've got, you know, every organization known to man, even the Goofs in Whitesburg, they've got a Facebook page, and a, you know, so I think that was a lot of Wildside getting its popularity, so to speak.
And you said exactly almost the same thing I was going to say. The biggest difference is when we established, you know, you have to remember the years that we're talking about here. Wildside got started. I got there in 99. It started in 98 with NCW. And our heyday WCW deal was 2001. Ring of Honor started after TNA started in 2002, and we had the guys from TNA, the commentators, trying out on our set for TNA. So we were really in place, and the internet really wasn't that active. You know, it was harder to do a show. We used to have to create spend money over at a production house to get a one-inch tape to send to our television stations, the networks, because that was the only way they were going to take it. You know, now I can send a 25-cent DVD out. It's just and everybody and their mother can get a digital camera and do a show at relatively the same quality. So that's what's made it more difficult for Anarchy. The one consistency between the two companies is the basic premise I brought to whatever I want to be involved in, whether it was that or even the brief time I was helping out at Rampage, is I'm not a promoter. I'm a terrible promoter. I'm just hideously bad.
But you get some hellacious nacho cheese.
What I'm in the business to do, other than to make great nachos, is to develop talent and then within the product use that talent to tell stories and teach. And it's a teaching process, and that's what made Wildside unique inevitably. The other stuff was important in helping that. And it's what makes Anarchy unique now. There's an awful lot of shows where people go and do matches. There are very few shows where the talent learns something every time they do a match. And I think that's the key difference between the system that was built in Cornelia, Georgia, and a lot of other things.
I'd like to touch on a couple other points from Steve's articles. One point he makes is that comparing it with Saturday Night Live is that they're at the center of controversy. And I'm wondering, for those of you who are, you know, on the inner circle of Anarchy, is that something you experience, you know, that people secretly or not so secretly hate anarchy, wish for its demise, hated Wildside, wish for its demise. How real was that to you when you were there, or is it, or now?
Let Jeff take the answer on this, because Jeff's
all right.
Always got the best response to the haters.
Well, I mean, it is true. I mean, I remember we would go do shows, and you know, there would just be guys in the locker room, especially in the middle Georgia area up that way, and it would just be like, it would go from, there's AJ Styles, I want to get his autograph and get my picture with him, and then there would be the guys going, there's those Wildside guys, they think they're better than us. And the guy who said this, I swear to God, this happened on a show. There's two guys, they're going to work Rain Man and Murder One in a tag match. And they came up and they were talking about, you know, and Rain Man goes, what is it you guys want to do tonight? And the one guy said, you know, we'll do whatever you want to do, but we just want to get a hot tag in because that always gets a pop.
Wow.
And that is pro wrestling outside of anarchy and Wildside 90% of the time. That's the kind of people at these shows who aren't good enough to be on these shows. So, of course, they're resentful. And, you know, there's the people that know they suck, and then there's the people who think they're great. There's a lot of guys out there who think they're great, who think they're better than anarchy guys. Like, well, I don't know why I'm not getting votes for Wrestler of the Year, because you're garbage. But, you know, that's the wrestling business in 2013. There's a lot
See,
of
that's what,
terrible,
that's what the Friday
terrible
nights were for.
There. Yeah, well, you know my opinion of those Friday nights then and now. So.
In early Wildside, we used to do opening matches. We would do dark, we'd call them dark matches, as if we're doing a pay-per-view or something. And we would put out all of these people that wanted opportunity, and at some level that even perpetuated into anarchy, and it led to some of the worst moments in the history of professional wrestling, guys who couldn't hit their own finish moves, all of whom who thought they were the biggest stars ever. Of course, there were good times. Big Wood came in and worked Adam Jacobs in one of those, with Adam getting a spot afterwards. So every once in a while, something really good happened. But it was amazing how much craptastic stuff happened before a good Wildside show at the beginning that a lot of people really don't remember, except those of us that endured it. And those things live in infamy. But most of those people that did those tryout matches, a very small number actually ever made it to a real match with us. And the people that didn't make it for years thought they were screwed, that we simply didn't see the big star that they were, and it was clearly our fault. We finally stopped doing those, by the way, because it wasn't our fault.
This Stephen Platinum, when I got to Atlanta, I got to Atlanta in 2001 and opened up a wrestling school, kind of put my own shingle out, and I, of course, like anybody else who was starting their own promotion and kind of doing their own thing, thought that, you know, I'm going to take over the world and I've got it all figured out. And so I tried to learn everything I could about wrestling that was taking place in the state. And I used to read the reports coming out of Wildside. And I remember going to a Wildside show, and it was very humbling. I thought, I'll train a group of guys, we'll start doing our own shows. It's you know, what PCW ended up being. But I thought we were going to just light the world on fire, and I went to Wildside and was instantly humbled. Other shows that I had been to, like Rocky King would put on a show and things like that, these shows that I would see, I would go like, holy crap, my stuff's going to blow this away, no problem. I saw Wildside, and it actually changed the way I booked, because I went, my guys aren't good enough. My guys can't wrestle like this yet. I'm going to have to become like a smoke and mirrors booker. And, you know, that was the early reputation of PCW of like, it's a bunch of actors that just wrestle, you know, all that stuff. But that came about as a result of me feeling the need to kind of bells and whistles our shows up, because I knew in ring and as far as like angles and like Jeff Hughes promos, like we couldn't compete with any of that. And so like that was a very humbling experience. That was my takeaway from Wildside, was just like, shit, I'm going to have to bust my ass just to catch up. So that was what I took away.
By the way, we are now joined by the Reverend Dan Wilson.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Better late than never.
That's how I roll. Ask Bill.
We all know.
That's right.
Especially if Tempers is in town.
Was my assistant in my real job. I was at one time a television syndicator until wrestling took over and destroyed my life. But prior to that, I had a TV production. I was on the road a lot, and I needed an assistant, and Dan became my assistant. And when I was there, he did a wonderful job. And then when I went away, he'd go on the Internet with Murder One and his friends and meet a future wife. So
yes, Bill rescued Dan from old Spotty in Steve's closet.
Hey, was the first time you announced for us, Dan, was that in Athens?
Yes, it was.
Because didn't the guy that we were using at the time, didn't he just decide he didn't want to do the show and just walked out after he was already there?
No, I tried Dan out, and then we brought him to the next TV taping. Dan did an okay job, but he tried too hard, and he overdid everything. He was, you know, really, really throwing the stuff out there, and he fixed himself very quickly. But the guy we were normally using heard that we had this, you know, hotshot new announcer kid. And to the best of my knowledge, I think he about ran Dan over, leaving the building the first time that Dan showed up.
Tried to run Dan down.
Who was it that we were using at the time?
He looked just like Larry Bird. I have no idea what his real name is, like most of those people.
I just remember he was Larry Bird.
That's all I fucking remember.
I just remember the guy was bad.
I would have been flattened.
It was like, who's this guy? But he sure is a breath of fresh air compared to what the guy they were using. That's what I remember about Dan in the Athens show. Hey, one of the points that Steve made is regarding the Anarchy Cornelia thing is even people who had bad experiences claimed them. I'm wondering who, in your guys' mind, are some of the legendary bad experiences as far as people coming to Anarchy and Wildside and having difficulties?
In names, I mean, probably one of the great examples in names, Davey Richards, first time he came in, broke a body part.
Yes.
That was on a Friday. I never even knew he was there. And the second time he came in, he had one of the worst matches in the history of the building with Tony Gazzina.
I'll tell the story on this because, he just won the Super 8 tournament, and we already had the booking lined up with him. And, you know, Davey looks like a good-looking kid, right? And he comes in, and then, you know, he puts together the match with Tony Gazzina, who's wearing a hood. And then they go out there, and Davey goes as a heel, even though in Cornelia he looks like the perfect baby face. And they do have a bad match. And not just a bad match for the building as far as style, anything, it's a very good example of somebody who came in and was like, don't believe the hype sometimes.
Yeah, so of my examples, we've had some other regional people who in theory were big deals. I'm forgetting a guy from North Carolina who came in and missed his own finish move in an opening match.
Mean
Jeff
Mark
may
Ash.
Remember who that was. Huh?
It was Mean Mark Ash, Bill.
Yes, Mean Mark Ash.
Oh, God.
Mean Mark Ash.
The master of the ash kicker.
Yes.
Yes.
He was one of the first indie wrestlers that was getting like a lot of press for some reason in magazines and everything. But the boy, when he came into Wildside, he stunk it up.
He still uses that profile picture that he took at Wildside as his main picture. Anytime you see him advertising something online, he uses that Wildside picture, wearing the same shirt that Dan once wore on commentary. And I was like, that's the Mean Mark Ash shirt, Dan. You can't wear that anymore. You should feel shame.
Every time
time Champagne came in, every time Marty came in, Marty really wasn't a great worker, but he was a really good talker. And every single time he came in, the mic failed him. Every time he was given a mic, the mic would go out on him, and it was all he had. I remember that vividly. The only good match Easy Money ever had in the building was the night Terry Taylor saw him, and he actually got a job out of it.
That's right. Easy Money, there would be fuck-ups in almost every one of his matches.
Mm-hmm.
We had a rough time there.
Yes. Yeah,
well, during when Bill was vice
people,
president of the NWA, we'd have, you know, some of those regional champions come in. And I remember, like, J.T. Wolfen came in, and that was pretty legendary.
He owned a great pizza place in Hawaii. He had that going for him.
And Big Dog,
yeah,
Brody.
Yeah, it was like Spunkmeyer. We had all the great stars. You know, there was a surprising, a lot of guys came into Wildside and still, quite honestly, come into Anarchy and tried to do too much. Now, in Wildside, frequently trying to do too much worked because most of the people we had were trying to do too much at the time. And it was almost everybody you were trying to rein in back then. First time I had huge heat with AJ, he was set up for a ladder match with Eddie Golden. Eddie Golden was a great, logical Southern heel. Really good worker, told great stories. Everything he did to me was believable. He was AJ's size. It was a perfect matchup, and Steve wanted a freaking ladder match for no real reason. Just, you know, it was Tuesday, you need a ladder match. And I said, why do we need a ladder match? You've got a great, and I think it was TV title, you've got a great match. Just let these two guys go out and tell a story. So they want to do the freaking match. AJ decided to do all these stupid spots. You know, he put the ladder on a chair. Eddie moves. AJ comes off the top and sentons the ladder and, you know, about kills himself. And, you know, it was all for good fun. And he comes to the back and he asked me what I thought of the match. And I said the match sucked. And that was the start of our relationship. First time Hot Stuff came in, he did all of his fly all over the place, you know, luchador 300-pound guy stuff. And he came to the back and he said, what do you think? And I told him it was terrible. We always had guys trying too hard, at least at the beginning. And inevitably, everybody learned slower in Wildside, a little quicker now in Anarchy. If you think you're going too slow, slow down. The art of telling a story as opposed to getting the spot over. Wildside was built on great spots. Eventually it was built on great spots in the right place.
Hey, for our Nashville listeners, a guy who's pretty infamous on the scene there now, Nick Nitros, what about the time he came into Wildside?
I can tell that story.
Oh, real quickly, because I don't remember.
Please, do you
don't
remember?
I don't remember him either. I remember him up in Nashville managing me and David, but I don't remember him coming to Wildside.
He was in an actual match.
Just sit down and shut your mouth. That's all he had.
But he was a wrestler, and he was in the match with Total Destruction, who, you know, were frequently known to beat the hell out of people on an extreme level. And he ran to the back. He's running through the go room. He left the ring during the match. He runs in the go room screaming at the top of his lungs, they're shooting on me. They're shooting on me. And everybody's looking at him like, what the hell is wrong with you? And about that time, here comes Sean Royal through the curtain, snatches him up and said, you're coming back to do the finish, boy. And they took him to the ring and did the finish on him.
Bill, where were we at for that?
And I don't believe he ever came back.
I was honestly just probably ignoring it, which is what I normally did in those moments. You know, the only time I got involved is when it really got out of hand. Like, there was one time where I think someone related to Slim J spit on Tank. And Tank decided to chase the kid out of the building. And I'm outside, and all of a sudden Todd comes out to the stairway and goes, Bill, Tank's about to go kill that kid. You need to do something. You know, so then I have to go up and run over and get in front of Tank, and he's seething. He's like a rabid bull. And, you know,
phlegm is flowing and this kid's cowering in the background. And so I look at him and go, Warren? And then all of a sudden he goes, you know, then all of a sudden he's kicking the ground and shuffling his feet and moving off. So frequently I missed these spots because I was, you know, I was out doing other things.
I'm glad you mentioned Slim J, because I think you all will agree that guy, even at his size, he should be a millionaire several times over. What a great piece of talent that doesn't get seen, you know, elsewhere. Mike.
Absolutely.
He had a pay-per-view at TNA that could have been his breakout. He was in a match with Kid Cash. It was well booked. They were putting him over well. Before the match, he'd been doing the little wigger thing that we'd established him with, and he used to grab his crotch a lot, just what he did. And before the match, I went to, you know, they had seen the guy. They knew him because Don West, he was like Don West's favorite, because Don used to come and do practice commentary on our shows, and Don loved him. I mean, he was all about the Slim J. So I said, well, you know, Slim comes out, and he grabs his stuff. You know, that's just what he does. When he comes out the curtain, do you want him grabbing his stuff? You know, and Jeff said, yeah, you know, let him do the full thing. That's what we need to do. So, by God, he's grabbing his stuff all the way on pay-per-view down to the ring. And in the headset, I then hear Jeff's dad, Jerry, going, what the hell is he doing, Bill? And that was the last we saw of Slim J at TNA.
Man. That guy deserves a much better fate. But, boy, what? Even today, just so innovative. Hey, Dan Wilson, how you doing, by the way?
Hey, doing great, man. How are you?
Good, man. Hey, I want to ask you, is your potty humor site still up?
We're having technical issues with the website right now, actually. But at the moment, the content is available on our YouTube page, which is the same as youtube.com/pottyhumor. The website will be fully functional, hopefully in a week or so.
Well, I was going to put you over, because anybody listening to this show, if you want more of this type of stuff, Dan, I think it was a four-part series you did with Bill Behrens, and those interviews, guys, were just fantastic, just all kinds of great stories. So that would be a great accompaniment to this show, I would think, for anybody.
Good stuff. He just did a couple with Iceberg. I'm sure a third to come that are up right now that are well worth listening to. You know, Iceberg is one of the very influential guys in the Wildside Anarchy time. A lot of Wildside history and into Anarchy flows around him. And in fact, Iceberg at one time booked Anarchy.
Well, Dan, let me, and this is a question for everybody, but I guess I'll start with you, Dan. I know this is hard to pick, but let's just say Wildside slash Anarchy. What would you say is the one defining moment if you actually had to pick one?
Well, it's so hard to pick one because of the different eras between the two promotions. You know, Wildside was almost like this punk rock metal, like guerrilla fucking operation. Whereas Anarchy, we'd learned a lot more by that point, so we'd slowed things down, and it was really a different style of product at that point. So if I'm going to cop out, I'm going to give you two. For Wildside, it definitely, to me, would have been the hardcore hell where we had Dusty Rhodes and the Six Man with AJ and Christopher Daniels essentially blowing off the big feud with the God Squad and the NWA Elite. Some of the most passionate performances by anybody ever in the building, and some of the most passionate work I did as a commentator, I think, was there. And then also in Anarchy, I've got to point to the first big War Games when the Devil's Rejects versus Team Anarchy feud was popping off. That was in 2006. And the people were just rabid. Everything was just firing on all cylinders, and you can't really ask for much more than that.
And how about you, Larry? Same question, because you've covered it almost since day one. Wildside, what do you see as the defining moment? Just a couple of them.
It's impossible. I mean, I have to cop out, too. It's impossible to say one. And one of the ones is absolutely the one that Dan mentioned, the night that Dusty Rhodes were there, that big blow-off. That was just an incredible night, definitely one of the defining moments. To me, a lot of it, too, goes back to in the early days, the insane main events with AJ Styles, where every show this guy is coming out and doing something amazing that I've never seen done before. You know, I'll just never forget those nights.
Mm-mm.
I'll chime in. My favorite match in Wildside history was the God Squad blow-off match for a variety of reasons. I, to this day, as the ring introductions progress, and when finally Dusty comes out, I can't get through that without, you know, it being like the end of Brian's song where I'm shedding man tears. It literally does that to me. If you go back and watch the match, the work by Chad Parham in the match was brilliant. The work by Alter Boy was spotty. The match itself was good, not great, but the setup the night before, the turn by Chris Daniels, the build to the next night. We used to do Hardcore Hells in two parts, Friday and Saturday, and that was one of the truly good times that we made both nights relevant by tying them together so strongly. So I think for a variety of reasons that brought all of the magic. Most of the people in the match were developed by Wildside. They were Wildside stars, but in there was a Wildside graduate in AJ, Chris Daniels, someone who came to Wildside and attempted to sell T-shirts for $15 to $20, a bargain at any price. And then we had Dusty Rhodes show up to sign his book early, and everybody thought Dusty had gone home. And then we bring Dusty out, and Dusty does spots. Dusty gets busy. Dusty points at the Wildside sign. We were blessed from above. Dusty's been given heat for being, you know, either a great booker, bad booker, or the devil, or a saint, but an awful lot of innovations professional wrestling when it comes to the branding of product, Dusty Rhodes was a genius, as having learned from Eddie Graham, as did Jerry Jarrett and others. And to get that nod in that moment was very important to me. We had accomplished a lot up to that point, that we were on the ride home at that point. Inevitably, I was, you know, the thing was going to fold up not that far down the road. But at that point, everything sort of clicked, and you know, the world was good for professional wrestling, as I believe the quote from Larry Goodman's review.
From Wildside era that I was there for was the AJ Cross series. Because as a worker, they were inventing stuff every night. And we were doing so many spot shows in Athens and South Carolina and stuff, so they were wrestling each other but still coming up with stuff that no matter how good you are as a worker, you couldn't duplicate just because the athletic ability involved of those two. That was just unbelievable at the time. And Anarchy is the War Games that Dan mentioned, too, because that was a peak moment in that building, I think, as far as emotion and people there and just awesome on every level.
For me, I would have to say probably two defining moments for me at Wildside. One being... actually, Bill coming on board and creating Wildside, and I'm looking at it from a different point of view than just being a talent, but just being able to take the promotion to another level. So that's one, is bringing Bill. And the other one for me that just stands out personally is the night that I worked Jeff after I had my back injury and everything, and came back and did that thing with Jeff, and Jeff took care of me, and that was
that's a fucking laugh. I'm nearly dying out there.
But no, seriously,
I appreciate you saying that, and not to jump in, but that's definitely on my list too, because I mean, you got hurt. We had almost that year-long build for it of, you know, me just saying the most horrible things about you being crippled and worthless and all those things. And then, I mean, we get in there, and I get that first spot on you, and I get you down, and I'm so blown up in the first 30 seconds, I thought I was going to die, literally die. And Andrew handed me a piece of tape that was on the mat, and he goes, choke him with the tape. So I got behind Rick, and I put the tape around his neck, and then I just leaned my head down into his shoulder, and I was just like, ooh, ooh, And all I'm thinking is, I still got to eat all four sides of this cage. I mean, whatever else we're going to do, at the bare minimum, I still have to go eat all four. So, I mean, Rick took great care of me that night because I was like a dead fish out there just flopping around. I mean, just like, wow. I had no idea I was that out of shape. I mean, it was frightening. I really thought I might die.
So let me say this. My defining moment with Anarchy was selling it. So there you go. Bye.
But another great moment, but it was also great on the follow-up, was the night that we had a near riot when the New South worked Bad Attitude.
Oh, yes.
And literally the police were called, and I was the heel manager at the time, and we're in the car trying to leave the building. We're blocked in by police. And the end of that story was the lady that had referred to Corey as something other than just African-American was told to apologize. But the ring was flooded, and it was, you know, trash was thrown everywhere, and it was one of those great moments. And interestingly, barely any of that ever saw the light of day because Steve never aired any of it. However, there was a turn later that Steve did just a little while past that, which is when we did the turn where I went babyface, and Steve made sure there were people in the crowd at that one to throw shit into the ring to try to duplicate that moment, which to me was yet another defining moment for Wildside. We got genuine heat, truly suspended disbelief, and the way Steve reacted to it was to try to manufacture the suspension of disbelief again.
And if I'm not mistaken, it was one of the longer matches up until that time in that building, because I think we went like 30-something minutes.
Yeah, and we had a guest referee that we got over that night as being relevant to the match, Chris Champion, who came in.
Yes.
So, you know, a lot of fun things that happened for the first time. I mean, first time Jay Briscoe wrestled Mark Briscoe, or the second time, it's still fought about. But it was, you know, one of those was in our building. Amazing Red had tremendous matches in our building. Ray Gordy was a longtime champion at the building and was a great big little guy. Jeremy Lopez came back from Osaka Pro and ended up redefining our junior division, quite literally. Tony Mamaluk taught almost all of the people that broke out after him how to work, including Todd, including Jimmy. Putting them in the ring with Tony Mamaluk made them better. And those are all things that you remember about Wildside. The Wildside thing. Anarchy, fortunately, had that same process. I mean, you know, you look at Phil Shatter Gunner right now, and you want to go back and look at pictures of that guy the day he arrived, he was a wadding water retention advertisement. I mean, he just was just bloated. He was huge. His thighs were the size of a building, but he was, you know, he was like a lot of guys who thought the only way to make it was to be as big as a building any way you could possibly get there. And finally, he turned a corner when Terry Taylor came to visit one time. Another thing that seemed to happen, people would come and visit and help. And I said, I can't get this guy to stop doing things he doesn't need to do, and it's holding him back. So Terry went over and introduced himself and said, hey, I'm Terry Taylor. What's your name, Roid Boy?
So, that's great.
And that changed how Chad did a lot of what he did. He changed entirely how he repositioned himself. And look at the guy now. I mean, and look at him back then, and it's a night and day difference, not only in appearance and work and the development of guys like that. We look at Xavier Woods, who developed with us as Austin Creed. He some of his early matches when he was teaming with Hayden Young, I would throw things. I remember just being violently angry at the fact that they couldn't put a match together for the life of them. But Austin had this tremendous charisma and eventually figured out how to work. And you know, look where he is now, first TNA, where he debuts with Ronnie Killings, and now WWE, where he debuts with Ronnie Killings. That Ronnie Killings did pretty well, too.
Yeah, and by the end of his time at Developmental, he was looked upon as a leader guy, leading other guys through matches, Xavier Wood. So there you go.
Well, Larry, since Stephen Platinum had this idea to compare Wildside Anarchy to Saturday Night Live, why don't we kind of let him take us out and just kind of, you know, give his thoughts on what, you know, what Wildside is to him, basically. What do you think?
Sounds good to me.
I put part three out today. I don't know if everybody saw it. My big wrap up was that, and again, this is probably going to upset any number of people outside of Anarchy and Wildside, but there is no comparison. People like to compare what they're doing to Anarchy, and I get critiqued because people go, "Oh, he doesn't criticize Anarchy and Wildside." The opposite is true. There was a time in a PCW locker room, and any number of my guys would attest to this, where I would say, in my mind, it's Rampage, it's Anarchy, and it's PCW. I said, we're the top three, not necessarily in that order. And my goal was to kick the shit out of them. And I made no bones about it. I'm like, we're going to run more shows. We're going to blah, 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 blah. You guys got to get better. I'll bring in who I have to bring in to balance out the show. But that couldn't take away from the fact that it was always about Wildside and Anarchy. They're the best. And I can admit that. And that's not easy for me to say. And another thing that I had to cut out of the article, and it's how I want to close, is I think part of the success of Wildside Anarchy, the thing that Stephen Rick started, it always came down to the training facility that's involved and an eye for talent. And what's so great about that is it should be the prototype that everybody follows. It's certainly the one that PCW did. Where now any comparisons people make between PCW and Anarchy, I get incredibly flattered. When guys like Jeter, you know, or the Bullets, when all of these guys get to wrestle for Anarchy, that's a big source of personal pride for me, because it's like guys that, you know, it's probably how like the Harvard Lampoon guys felt when all of those guys end up writing for Saturday Night Live, because that's how I knew what I was doing was working, not just because PCW had sort of taken its place in Georgia indie wrestling and, you know, Rampage got kicked down the stairs, but I had to get that in. But because, you know, now PCW guys were good enough to be there. And again, I don't care whatever happens with that show. Anarchy, I mean, someday, it always feels like wrestling will always be in that building. More than that, though, it feels like it should always be that way. There's greatness, and I talk a lot about greatness in sort of my personal life and how nowadays people hate greatness. They really do. If you're truly great, people just have this desire to tear you down, whether it's, you know, LeBron James, it's like, I just hate him, where there was a time where greatness was celebrated. Nowadays, people can only be jealous, and I just wanted to put something out there that said, look, Saturday Night Live is great. That's how I thought of it. I was reading the Saturday Night Live book, and there was all this, you know, they kept talking about how every few years it would come around Saturday Night Dead. That would be the clever media response to Saturday Night Live. Oh, it's like, oh, it's dead. It's dying. And I go, how many times has that toe tag been put on Wildside or Anarchy for various reasons, but yet what happens is, you know, you guys had the great blow off with the Jerry Palmer like Civil War angle, and then everyone's like, okay, well now they're done, And it's like, what are they doing, all these three-person teams? This stuff doesn't make sense, blah, 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 wah, wah, wah. And to Bill and Todd's credit, what they did was they just reinvented themselves again. That's what the great ones do and why, honestly, most every other league doesn't matter. And they should be looking at you guys and going, God, we've got greatness right here in the state. And instead of pretending like they aren't great, people should just be thankful that they're there. And if you're a wrestler, you should be trying to be there. That's just how I feel about it. Do I think PCW is wonderful? Of course I do. It's run by a genius, but beyond that, I mean, how many years is it going to take? How many shows is it going to take? How many things is PCW going to have to go through to even reach halfway where Anarchy is? And if people want to say that I'm, like, riding your nuts or whatever, it is what it is. On Raw, Austin showed up, and he's working – his tag team partner came through Wildside, and they're working a team led by another guy who worked those shows. What else is there to say? Until any of these leagues, and that includes PCW, until we can say, hey, look at the lineage of guys that were here. Look at what the bookers have done. Look at what the guys running these shows have pulled off. In the long run, I mean, it's just not even a question. I think, you know, there's always this debate of who's the number one league. And really, it's sort of a – it's kind of a red herring question because it's Wildside and Anarchy. It just is. And I guess, if you want me to wrap it up, I'll just wrap it up by saying being able to acknowledge greatness is an important step that I think nowadays guys just don't understand. I think wrestlers who put, you know, I'm watching a match with Dory Funk Jr. in it. Man, it's great. I'm learning so much. They're not learning anything. Because what they should be doing, instead of just watching that match, which they should, and learn from it, they should be busting their ass to get to the places where you can learn how to draw, how to make money, instead of worrying about a $30 payoff at some podunk league that nobody cares about. You should be honored. I mean, just like those Saturday Night Live writers and performers were honored just to get the call. Just to be able to work on that show, I think people are losing sight of the fact that who cares if there's 125 people watching your shit show? It's about working in that building. If you come through Georgia and you don't work there, you ain't shit. And that's my that's my finale on that.
Well. Thanks, everybody, for participating tonight.
Well, I just want to thank Stephen Platinum for writing that stuff. And I've watched Saturday Night Live since its inception. And even though it is sometimes terrible, it's still in my DVR to this day. And I fast-forward through chunks of it. But I still watch it, and it occasionally nails it. And to be compared to something of that level of greatness is truly an honor. And I just appreciate him writing it and acknowledging our and, more importantly, my greatness.
Can I chime in right quick before you let go, Harry?
Go ahead.
Because this is probably it's probably one of the rare few and only times that Dragon, Bill, and Jeff, and Todd, and everybody will be all in one lump sum here where I can speak. I've readily admitted I've made a shit ton of mistakes in my life and throughout my career, but I want to just go on record and publicly apologize for anything and everything that I've done that has offended you guys or that has pissed you off or that I've done, said, or anything like that. And Wildside or NCW was just a little dream. And you guys have taken it to a whole nother level, and it was an absolute honor to work with all you guys at Wildside, and I just want to say thank you for some of the best times ever in my career. All of you guys are awesome. And Steve, thank you so much for the write-up. And Larry Goodman, thank you for all the great reports you've done throughout that whole building. And there was somebody else on there talking that I don't catch who that is, but thank you for just whatever. But anyway, that's what I wanted to say.
Ray, this is, okay, I'll say something real quick to Ray, because I haven't talked to Ray in years, and no reason not to. It just hasn't happened. I've always told Bill that when I was booking, I was disappointed that I can never book Rick Michaels and the character and everything, even though you weren't at 100% because you're back. Also, the period, our Friday Night Feud was one of the most fond I'd look upon back. Stuff I did is us doing Friday nights, just me and you laying it out and going out there and doing it and building up to our cage match. That was a very fond time, and I don't think I've ever told you that. And like I said, I haven't talked to you in years, so I wanted just to let you know that why I had you.
Thank you. That means a lot. Thank you very much.
And by the way, Rick, the guy you didn't know, that's me, Trent Van Dries. Hello.
Oh, Lord, you. Okay, you're awesome. Yeah, you were... You were one of the few people in the Tennessee board that liked me.
Yes.
So thank you for never saying bad things about me on the Mid-South board.
Well, fucker.
And Bill, I have a question for you.
Yes.
What in the Sam Hill are you doing up so late?
I was thinking the same thing.
I don't know.
We're all winning that. this is totally throwing off everything. By the way, let me thank everyone involved. I've appreciated Steve. Thank you for spending the time to point out, some of the things we've done, and I hope things that have made what we've all been able to accomplish together mean something. One of the, as we go back to Saturday Live, and I'll end with this. One of the things I've always been cognizant of as I've watched Saturday Live is nobody that goes on that show is paid. They all get scale. Everybody that goes on Saturday Night Live does it for scale. I don't know if you see the biggest star there. When the Beatles were going to perform, they were going to have to give less to Ringo. That's the way the deal works. And I think another way that we're comparable is for anybody where it was about the money, we were never the place to be. I told everybody that came in that had potential that if we did our job right, other people would want to book them, and that's where they'd make their money. But they would never make it in the environment that was Wildside or Anarchy. They had to work for scale. And I think that is a great similarity between it. And still, big stars came in and worked for scale. Dusty Rhodes, when he appeared, worked for nothing twice. Ole Anderson came in for nothing. I can go on and on with the people that came in there for nothing and wanted to. Ed Ferrara came in for an extended period of time simply because he wanted to run an angle and be there. He wanted something positive after WCW went out of business. And it goes on and on. It's been a joy to be around the people that wanted to be there because it allowed everything we were trying to do to be relevant when at times it became frustrating. It's what keeps you going. And let me say this. We're all sitting around here, jerking each other off. It is nice when we go into a building with so much history and there may not be a good crowd there and the show may be good or it may not be good, but it is nice to see that, what we do is recognized. It is, and it's recognized to us because we were all part of it and we're all very aware of the history, but for Steve to write what he wrote and to say what he said, it's very nice to see that. It's appreciated, and it is, people are aware of what we've done in this, what was a barn or a schoolhouse. Nobody's really sure, and we've turned it into what it's turned into.
It was actually an old school gymnasium built in 1902.
Well, as someone who's been appreciating it since 1999 and still appreciates it and been to hundreds of shows there, and one of the things I would hear is somebody who, writes about shows as well, you always favor that Anarchy, or you always favor Wildside. Well, there's a reason for that, and I think what Steve wrote in his article is a lot of those reasons. So thanks to all of you for all of the thrill.
It also makes you more disappointed when we betray that, like when we did a 5-minute main event where Azrael became champion, and you, when the show was over, you stood up in the stands and said, "Everyone deserves their money back. This was crap."
I wasn't there for that. I just want to point that out.
Yeah, that was the one time, all the time I noticed that I really just threw a fucking fit in that building. You're right.
it was tremendous. And by the way, you were caught off guard as I was by that.
Yes.
They ran through the finish of that match, and I loved it. It was great. I just didn't know the finish was the entire match.
I almost punched the referee in the face, thinking he was the one who had blown the finish.
Well, Jeff and I were involved in the calling of that match, right? And so they come up and say, "Look, here's what we got. Okay, we're going to do this." Look, okay, well, that sounds good. You know, it's most guys who are seasoned and know how to work, they give you the highlights, they give you the rundown, but there is usually lots of filler in between that. You're not throwing the case there.
Yeah, that's completely honest. What happened that night, there is no explanation for.
I got a phone call the next day about that, so, yeah, that's when I remember that.
That was your, I guess that was your Sinead O'Connor ripping up the picture of the Pope.
That was a good
nice.
One, yeah. Oh,
good
Dan,
times,
by the
great
way.
Memories.
Yeah, I just want to throw this out to Dan, who I haven't talked to in eons. J-Dog texted me and was wondering when we were going to start talking about metal.
I'm always game to talk metal, but I don't know that this is the forum for it.
I know, but he just knows how to mean you get together, so he was waiting for that. I wanted
to know that.
As we say goodbye, I will point out there's one other thing that is infamous in the building, and that is, and it used to piss the crap out of me when I was making money out of the building, is most of the relationships of my crew came out of my crowd. And every time they did, it became a free guest. And it used to piss the crap out of me.
Franklin cut that same promo a few weeks ago, a couple of months back, I remember.
Yeah.
No comment.
Exactly, no comment.
Good night, guys.
Good night, everybody.
Bye, guys. Good night.
Good night. Very well.
You take the blue pill. The story ends. You wake up in your bed and believe whatever you want to be. You take the red pill. You stay in Wonderland. And I show you how deep the rabbit hole goes.
Thank you for listening to this broadcast, a production brought to you by the GWH Radio Network. Stay tuned to GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com for the latest information on upcoming events and more. As always, we thank you for your continued support.